This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
One of my favorite quotes is from Eleanor Roosevelt, who's like, you know, my absolute icon. And she said, always do that which you are most afraid to do. And so, you know, fear is there. Fear is what it is. But I think courage and bravery is when you do that which you're fearful about. It's when you try to find ways to overcome that fear, when you try to find ways to confront that fear. And I think that's where courage comes from. So that's something that's internalized. And then there's also the external pressures that we have, you know, where society defines, you know, what is brave and what is cowardice. For instance, someone who's a pacifist who refuses to fight in a war, for me, is brave and not a coward because they are standing up for what they believe in. So it's so complex, and these labels that we put on ourselves and on each other, we have to unpick every single label because one word can mean so many things.
Life isn't black or white. It's different shades of grey, with every colour in between. But we often forget our complexities, and we fail to allow ourselves to be vulnerable, to be a contradiction, to acknowledge that we can be afraid, alone, and in need. Welcome to another episode of Because Feelings Matter on Health and Living with me, T. Shaoik.
My name is Sumitra Viswanathan, and I'm the Executive Director of Women's Aid Organization.
Sumitra's story today is about being a human rights activist and how that has shaped her attitude towards her mental health.
So when I was thinking about how I was going to introduce myself, I was in a way framing it from the perspective of my professional experience. But I think introducing myself as a person, I want to think about several words that I feel describe me. So, you know, I am strong, I am intelligent, I am ethical, and I am committed to service, to make life better for other people. I am also emotional, I am fearful of many things, and I am quite vulnerable when it comes to certain triggers. So, you know, that may not adequately encapsulate everything that is Sumitra, but those are kind of like the buzzwords that come up for me. So that is who I am. And I want to make it clear that we are this bundle of grayness, right? We're so many things all in one, either, you know, from experiences or upbringing, environments that we've been in, experiences that we have had. But for me, I feel that I am both brave and I'm fearful at the same time. And it's that clash that, for me, triggers my mental health struggles.
Sumitra was raised with a strong sense of duty towards others, and this became inseparable from who she was and what she did.
I was born in 68, so I had my early childhood was like throughout the 70s, and it was your regular cookie cutter, middle class Malaysian upbringing. My dad was a headmaster. My mom was a home mom, meaning she managed the household. And, you know, school, home, but the environment in which we were raised, there were two things I think that was very important. One was the absolute emphasis that my parents had on reading. It was extremely important to read, and extremely important to be aware of current issues. So I was actually encouraged to read newspapers from a very, very young age. And our dad would ask us questions from the newspapers. And then the other thing also, which I feel was very important, was that service, that will to serve. Because my dad being a headmaster and then my mom being very supportive in everything that he did and supported a lot of the, you know, the work that he was doing in nurturing students, it really instilled in me a sense of service. So I felt One, the importance to know, to learn, to grow. And the other thing that I felt was that there was always something bigger than me. There was always a greater cause. There was always a better kind of world that we should be aspiring to, a better life for people. And I always felt, and this I don't know whether it was instilled in me or whether it's something that grew, but I always felt a deep responsibility in myself that I had to be part of that struggle to make people's lives better. I don't know where it came from. I don't know whether it was my upbringing, my parents, or whatever, something that I read maybe as a child, but I feel responsible to make people's lives better.
Human rights work was a natural progression when Sumitra began thinking about what kind of education and career she wanted to pursue.
I did a law degree, and throughout my law degree, it was very clear to me that I didn't want to come back and practice at the bar and, you know, represent clients or, you know, buy and sell land. That wasn't an interest for me at all. What I wanted was to work in human rights. So, you know, in my late teens, it was that whole Operation Lalang period. And then, you know, there was that whole constitutional crisis with the judiciary. And it really opened my eyes in such a fundamental way to, you know, the importance of human rights, not just for an individual, but also that ethics around which a nation needs to be built. And then the other thing is also the cultural experience that my family had, because our origin is Jaffna Tamil, and we had family members also in Sri Lanka. And at that time, you know, when I was around 15, there was a lot of strife, internal Sri Lanka, and our family members there left and went to another country and became refugees. So that whole idea of, you know, nationhood, the idea of belonging, the right to be part of a community, the right to hold a passport, you know, the right to be safe in your own country, all of that became so deeply embedded in me. So when I did my law degree, it became absolutely clear to me that I wanted to use my legal knowledge to advance human rights. So I, after my degree, I immediately joined the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. And I got sent off to a very remote refugee camp on an Indonesian island somewhere. And so I worked there for more than a year. And it was with Vietnamese boat people. And then after that, I was posted to Hong Kong, where I stayed for longer. It was also with Vietnamese boat people. And then I did like various postings around the region. And then I took breaks in between, you know. And I realize now in hindsight, the reason why I took those breaks was because even though I did not actually give it a name or articulate it to myself, it was this whole concept of what they call secondary trauma or secondary PTSD. So the work that I did was with refugees, and obviously refugees are people who leave their country because they've suffered really bad treatment. And an intrinsic part of my job was listening to all of those stories. I have listened to thousands of refugee stories in my entire UNHCR career. And I failed to realize how much those stories impacted me. So, you know, because as a professional, you're listening, you're assessing, you're evaluating, and then you're trying to present solutions, you know, what's the best solution for this person, and then supporting them through it, and then seeing how their lives change. And, you know, it's very rewarding. But when you listen to these stories constantly, you don't realize how much it impacts you. And I think at that point, UNHCR as an organization as well, didn't make sufficient allowance for staff who were confronting these kinds of persecution and experiences didn't also, as an institution, recognize that it was having an impact on their staff and that they had a responsibility to protect staff from that kind of trauma also. So I took several breaks, but I always went back because, again, you know, this deep, I don't know where it comes from. It have this very deep sense of responsibility that I have to make people's lives better. I can. I know I can. And so I have to do it.
Unlike some other people who struggle to find their calling or their place in this world, Sumitra always knew where her true north was. But that was at times in conflict with her well-being, until she learned to create boundaries for herself. After the break, how Sumitra's journey as an activist and advocate also became her mental health journey. This is Because Feelings Matter, a series featuring personal stories of people and their mental health issues. Stay tuned to Health and Living BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiaoyik, bringing you another episode of Because Feelings Matter. On the show today, Sumitra Viswanathan, Executive Director of the Women's Aid Organization. Before she joined WAO, however, she spent many years working with refugees, helping to safeguard the rights and safety of some of the most vulnerable people in the world. However, the work profoundly affected her mental health. Sumitra shares about how mental health had been something she'd always been aware of throughout her childhood.
My dad struggled with depression his entire life. He had certain triggers, you know, extreme stress would trigger him. But something that my mom knew, and which I think as an adult now, I think as children, we also knew, it was loss that triggered him. So loss of his parent, loss of a beloved dog, you know, loss of a close friend. And that would trigger him to go into a very deep depression. And then my parents were responsible with regards to mental health as well as physical health. So whenever my father went into those spaces, he always had access to professional medical help. And my mother gave him the support and made sure that he had the emotional support. And for the rest of us kids, we always knew that, you know, there was this moment when we would be told, okay, everybody, daddy's not well. So, you know, keep it down, keep it quiet, be good children. And this is something that we accepted as sometimes people get unwell, not just in your body, but also in your mind. And it's something that he struggled with his entire life.
Little did Sumitra think that she would experience her own mental health issues following the effects of her work. On paper, her daily responsibilities included assessing the protection and assistance needs of refugees and asylum seekers. In reality, what this meant was she was speaking to hundreds of boat people who had fled Vietnam and hearing them recount over and over the atrocities that they had suffered, the trauma of being persecuted in their own homeland, and their broken dreams and hopes.
The first thing that would start to happen with things like nightmares, constant nightmares, and then reliving. You know, so even though I have only heard the other person's experience, but in my mind, it happened to me, you know. So if someone describes, like, I don't know, some horrible, you know, act against them, and over time in my mind, it would become like, it was me, I went through that. And then the cringe feeling that you have inside, and then you get to the stage where you think, there's no way I can listen to yet another story like this. I just cannot. I can't do it. But before you get to that stage, there are other things that happen. You know, you snap at your friends. You cry for no reason. You shut yourself away. I mean, there are also people who self-medicate with alcohol and tobacco and other substances. And so it's this absolute lack of self-awareness that you get because you lose the sense of yourself. So when you lose the sense of who you are within all of this, like these hundreds of stories, you lose who you are. So even attempting self-awareness is no longer possible because who are you really? You don't know that anymore. And then it's being unable to wake up in the morning and go to work and, you know, feeling I just can't do this anymore. And then just walking away.
How many times did you go through that cycle before you realized you needed to reach out for help?
Three times. I went through that three times. Yeah. And so the last time was, you know, thankfully it was a situation where I was posted back to Malaysia and I was working in Malaysia. And it was a very intense period of time when, you know, we were like handling tens of thousands of cases to be resettled. And luckily, I was living with my sister. And it was a safe space. And she was someone I trusted absolutely. And my mind told me, this is where you can completely break down. And that's what happened. I just completely broke down. And that is also when I connected to a mental health professional who is both a therapist and a psychiatrist. And he helped me. He helped me find myself again. He helped me find the right medication for myself. And he's someone that I still see. 20 years later, I still see him.
How did you feel when you were told that there was a name and a process to describe what you were going through?
It was a eureka moment. That in itself, the way you say it, you know, it's like when there's a name and a process. Yes, absolutely right. And it was like a eureka. Oh, that's why I felt like that. That's why this happened. That's why I treated that person like that. That's why, you know, so everything kind of started to make sense. And you know about PTSD, but you don't know about secondary PTSD, you know? And secondary PTSD is something that's often experienced by care workers. And I think care workers feel somehow self-indulgent. And it's like, you know, what, and guilt. I am supposed to help you, but I should not be feeling unwell because of you. But essentially, that's what secondary PTSD for care workers is. That's what it is. But so many of us are so consumed by exactly what I said, that deep responsibility to care and protect, that we feel guilty saying, I also need help.
At any point, did you worry that you could have been a risk to yourself?
Oh yeah, many times. Many times. Some too personal to go into. But I would say since that time, you know, I took time off, but then I went back to UNHCR and I felt strong enough to continue and the work continued. And then, you know, as you get higher up in your career, you take on more responsibilities and in more dangerous places. And I felt that I had the coping mechanism. And I had the medication also to assist me, and I was able to deal with some of the worst experiences and also to help the people who are working for me, the people who were, I was supervising, you know, I was in so much a better place to be able to help them recognize the situation that they were in. But yes, but there was one situation where I felt I had put myself into a place of severe risk to myself because I was too focused on looking after everyone else. And actually, at that moment, that's when I quit the UN forever and came to work for Women's Aid Organization, because it just got to the stage where I didn't have any more boundaries between my safety and the work that I needed to do.
The change in careers was not only a conscious decision to distance herself from the trauma she was experiencing, but also one where she could start afresh in terms of balancing her values with her well-being.
For me, the way out is actually being executive director. It's kind of a cop-out, but that's what it is. Because I don't get my hands dirty anymore. I mean, and I use that within quotes, right? I don't deal with individual cases anymore. Because I just simply cannot. I can't do it. And I realized this early on, maybe within the first 6 months of me being executive director. And there was one situation where a child was, you know, life support and because of abuse. And his mom wanted me to be present when she turned off the machine. And I can talk about it now, but before it was, I just couldn't even mention it. And she wanted me to be there with her. She couldn't do it on her own. So I was. And it affected me for, it still affects me, but yeah. So anyway, so since then, I thought, you know what, 30 years of doing this, I am going to take a step back. And this is what I can do. So what I can do is I can create a working environment for other women and men who are doing this work so that they feel supported, they feel empowered, then they have the support, the psychosocial support that they need when they need it. They have the supervision that's not going to take advantage of them. And the mantra is reasonable hours, reasonable workload for reasonable pay. And I promised myself that WAO will not be built on the backs of overworked and underappreciated women. That will never happen under my watch. So everything that I know, everything that I learned, everything that I experienced, for me right now, I'm 55 now, 5 years off retirement. And for me, it's about transferring what I know. It's about using my experience to support others. It's about, you know, holding out my hand to those who are in a dark place, you know, holding up my hand to say, for my staff, you know, I'm here. This is my hand. And let's get you out of this space. That's it. That's all I can do right now.
Have there been hands reaching out to you and saying, yes, I do. I'm going through this crisis. I can't cope.
All the time, Xiaoying, all the time. It's because of the kind of work that we do. And there's so many, and I'm going to make a bit of a plug as well. You know, social work and support for women, crisis support for women, refuge, etc. It's so undervalued in our country. It's so deeply important, but it's so undervalued. And yeah, you know, the team, they feel alone. They feel alone in a very bleak landscape because, you know, the challenges are so acute and the mindset is such that, you know, it's misogyny all the way. You go to the police station, you deal with misogyny. You go to the courts, you see that. You go everywhere you go. You, together with the woman that you're supporting, you are constantly facing a barrage of struggles and challenges and negative mindsets and misogyny. And for this group of feminists who are working so hard to change Malaysia, it is really emotionally hard. It's really hard.
Many aid workers experience this isolation, not only in terms of feeling undervalued, but also the physical loneliness they experience when they're posted in remote locations far away from their families and friends. Having gone through this herself, Sumitra recognizes the value of organizations stepping in to provide that support system, even though it is an uphill battle.
Here's the problem with the institution, because so many workers, they will always fear having their mental health being viewed as a negative performance issue. That is something that's very difficult to navigate, because the staff member needs to feel safe, needs to feel that this is going to be handled confidentially and sensitively by my HR, and it's going to be kept separate from whatever performance evaluation that's going to happen. Achieving that is going to be pretty hard for any organization. But, you know, we have to walk that path. We really do need to.
That same push and pull exists for all of us. Sumitra, for instance, will never be completely shielded from encountering the trauma of others. There would always be someone whose need was greater than hers. But what has she learned in terms of coping skills that allows her to sometimes cross that boundary and still be able to pull herself back in?
Talking, sharing, safe spaces, safe emotional spaces within the team. And I am extremely open with my team about my mental health journey and my mental health struggles. And I encourage people to be the same, because the more we talk about it, the more we destigmatize it. When people see me, when they see me, you know, speaking in a panel or, I don't know, on the radio or whatever, people immediately have a certain perception of, you know, Sumitra is this. But, you know, I'm vulnerable. I have a condition. I take medication for it. And without it, I won't be able to function at the level that I am right now. And there is no shame in that whatsoever. So that safe space, you know, being open and honest and talking about things, respecting boundaries. There's no magic pill. There's no easy answer. But the best that we can do is to talk, to hear each other, and to walk in each other's shoes as much as we can.
Have you ever encountered stigma?
Yes, in different ways. So, you know, sometimes people who have the best possible intentions and they say things like, Sumitra, why are you taking this medication? Don't open your heart to God, you know, God will, you know, et cetera, whatever. So if it works for you, great, but don't impose it on someone else. There's nothing wrong with the fact that I take a pill to help me get through the trials of the day. I've also found that, you know, sometimes when I go to the pharmacy and, you know, ask for my antidepressant, I always like get a second look and a third look, you know, and which I find a bit weird. Sometimes it happens. But it, apart from that, in the space in which I operate, I think people appreciate the fact that I'm open about the struggles that I've gone through and the measures that I take to help me through whatever else is happening.
Many of us may not know what it's like to be a care worker, to put service to others ahead of yourself. But with extremely high rates of stress, trauma, and burnout among humanitarian aid and care workers, it's vital to remember one thing: not to lose sight of yourself.
Be kind to yourself. You know, anyone who's listening to this, who's struggling with, you know, feeling in a dark space, feeling bleak, feeling hopeless, not knowing what to do, not knowing who to reach out to. And, you know, often we have so many expectations of ourselves, and other people also put expectations on us. And we need to just put that aside very gently and just be kind to yourself and just say, I'm going to take care of myself right now. You know, just say that. Wake up in the morning and just say that. I'm going to take care of myself today. And do that every day. And see if it takes you to a better place. There's no magic bullets. There's no one, you know, it's not painting by numbers. It's your journey. And be kind to yourself and just tell yourself, I am going to take care of myself today.
This has been Because Feelings Matter, a series featuring personal stories of people and their mental health issues. If you missed any part of the show, or if you'd like to listen to previous podcasts, you can search for it on bfm.my or on our BFM app. You've been listening to Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.